Seems like after every fire season, the record books need rewriting. Millions of acres have burned in Texas, and here in Arizona, the Wallow Fire will go down as the largest in Arizona history. Fires have long been part of the natural order here in the Southwest, but why are they burning hotter and scorching more acres than ever? We'll look at the causes. Could climate change be part of the problem? And we'll ask what's being done to make the forests and the people who live here less vulnerable to those big burns. Plus, we'll check in on the Flagstaff Festival of Science and learn what the ancient Mayans knew about 2012. I'm guessing it's probably not the end of the world as we know it. All coming up after this break. Stay with us.
This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to squarespace.com and enter the coupon code ScienceFriday9.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're in Flagstaff, Arizona this week, broadcasting from the campus of Northern Arizona University. It's been another record-breaking year for wildfires here in Arizona. The Wallow Fire, which burned more than 500,000 acres this summer, is the largest fire ever in the state. The previous record holder burned just shy of 500,000 acres in 2002. And here, closer to Flagstaff, last year's Schultz Fire took 15,000 acres. Fires, of course, are not uncommon in this part of the country. Flagstaff sits surrounded by the world's largest contiguous ponderosa pine forest, a type of forest that needs fire to renew itself. But scientists say decades of putting fires out has caused the forest to get too dense, making them more susceptible to those big, hot, devastating fires. So, are these giant fires inevitable? Can dedicated forest management help to control them? And what role is climate change playing? This hour, we're going to talk with someone who fights these big blazes, ask what it's like on the front lines of these fires, talk about people who manage them, and everything you wanted to know about forest fires. We hope to get into some sort of topic today, this hour. If you're here in the audience, we invite you to go up to the microphone and step up to the mic and not be afraid and ask your question. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I, and if you want more information, you can go over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Right here on my left is Wally Covington. He is Regents Professor of Forest Ecology at Northern Arizona University. He's also the Executive Director of the University's Ecological Restoration Institute. He's Mr. Forest Fire. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back. Good to see you in person.
Good to see you.
First time. We talk on the phone all the time. Mary Latta is a fire ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service in Flagstaff. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
And Paul Sommerfeld is a firefighter and a Type 1 team incident commander. Just what that means, Type 1, and we'll find out during the hour. He's also the Wildland Fire Management Officer for the City of Flagstaff. Paul, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Wally. Let's talk about this Wallow Fire first. Over 500,000 acres burned. Hard to imagine. Such a big fire.
It sort of is, and it's sort of not hard to imagine. I think many of us in forest ecology and fire ecology in particular have been talking about this coming for 20 or 30 years now. What we've been seeing over the past 30 years is fires shifting from surface fires in these ponderosa pine and frequent fire forests into crown fires, and then larger and larger crown fires.
You mean crown meaning the top of the tree?
Right, burning through the treetops instead of just through the grasses and the pine needles that are on the surface. They're fundamentally different processes in forest ecosystems.
And why the shift, you say, over 20 years?
Well, the shift over the past 20 or 30 years, if you look at this over time, frequent surface fires shaped the evolutionary ecology of ponderosa pine forest and dry mixed conifer, a number of other forest types, over tens of millions of years. With Euro-American settlement and overgrazing, the grass that used to carry fire to sweep across the landscape in the understory was eliminated. At that point, then, we set up the perfect conditions for a population eruption of trees, and that's what happened. But it takes a while for these trees to grow up and get large enough so that they can serve as a fuel ladder and carry fire from the surface into the canopies of the trees. And then what's happened over the past 30 to 40 years is that we've gotten more and more of the landscape filled in with these trees, so that the fires are no longer 1,000 acres or 10,000 acres. They're now on the scale of hundreds of thousands of acres.
So it's easy for the fire to spread and jump around
from
place to place. Mary, much of the blame for these huge fires is put on the Forest Service and their policy of putting fires out. Has that thinking changed on that?
It has changed. That way of thinking started probably in the early part of the century or earlier with European ideas about fire. And then we had Bambi and we had Smokey Bear, and people continued to think of fire as something to be avoided and put out. They saw it burning up trees, which they assumed was a bad thing. Over the last, particularly the last probably two or three decades, we've begun to much more readily recognize the role of fire in the system, and that part of the problems we have came from putting it out. So we have this dichotomous challenge in front of us now. On one side, put it out, it's going to burn my house, it's going to do damage. On the other side, wait, we need to let it burn. We need to reshape the system. So this project that we're working with now, the Four Forest Restoration Initiative, which to save 10 syllables, we'll call Four Fry from now on.
Okay, good. It's like sci-fry. We understand.
Exactly.
Yeah, we get that. Four Fry.
Right, and this is based on the work by Wally and other people in this area in particular for probably 10 years or more in trying to work on a scale that's going to make a difference.
And can you give us an idea of what that is? What is it, a cooperative effort among different players?
Yes, the public is very involved in this. There's a very active group of the public that are called the stakeholders with a capital S. That is over 30 individual public entities who are very involved. They do research for us. They work with us. They meet once a month. They've been absolutely critical to this. It isn't just the Forest Service doing this. This is it's a collaborative process in the truest sense of the form.
So everybody involved, whether it's the Forest Service, the timber people,
yes,
the state, the municipalities, they know now collectively the value of creating these small fires and getting rid of the brush and weeding out.
Yes, and
forest.
Small in the sense of the size of the flames,
right.
Not the extent, right?
Right. So everybody's on board with this idea. It seems really interesting you've gotten the disparate parties to be able to agree on something. This country agreeing on something now is hard to come by, isn't it?
Well, we have a few detractors out there, but the stakeholder group encompasses such a broad faction of the people out there who would be involved that we've been able to work through what otherwise would be issues that would hold this process up.
Mm-hmm. And Paul, tell us, what does a wildland fire management officer do?
Well, the program in Flagstaff started in 1996 as a direct result of several large fires that burned adjacent to the community and in the community that year. And it scared people. For those who lived here, panic was a norm. People felt that they were going to lose their neighborhood, their home. They were packing cars and leaving town. Summer visitors weren't coming. And it was a smoke hung over town for a long period of time. As a result of that, there was a decision made that we could not allow this to occur again. And we needed to take steps to prevent that. So the program that I manage and lead was started as a result of that.
And tell us what a Type 1 team incident does, or it is.
There are 16 national Type 1 incident management teams in the country. And I am the incident commander for one of those teams. And the teams average about 55 people each. Those are teams that are brought in to manage large events, primarily fire, but it can be other things, that overrun or overwhelm a local entity's ability to manage, either by size, cost, values at risk, whatever has triggered that need.
So you get in touch with all the agencies or all the local communities and coordinate things?
Well, when we go to an incident, we've been asked to come by those entities,
right.
And we manage the incident. We will plan operations. We will manage all the logistical side of supporting that. We put the firefighters on the line, give them objectives, ensure their safety, spend a lot of money.
I bet.
A lot of money.
I
and
bet.
That's If I was not concerned about this issue for any other reason than financial, that would bring me to this table.
Yeah. Let me, in a few minutes before we go to the break, let me ask you about starting these small fires for fire control. How do you keep them under control so they don't get into big fires?
So one of the things, you know, I came to NAU back in 75, and the first I came here, I thought, well, the simple solution, if fire caused the problem, you just put fire back in, it'll solve the problem. Tried working with the Forest Service on a number of those and found out you kill the trees with that. And
they hate it when that happens.
They get out of control. Yeah, I could have. In 1979, I was almost the shortest-lived professor ever to show up when we had a crown fire from one of my experimental projects. But anyway, so what we discovered was that the first thing you need to do is to thin out the excess trees that have come in since fire exclusion. And that is literally hundreds and hundreds of trees per acre. And then you can safely burn. So it's kind of like if you look at it from a human health standpoint, if your blood pressure is 180 over 105 and you weigh 150 pounds more than you should, you don't just jump on a treadmill and start running.
Right.
The first thing you got to do is get your body into a condition where you can start, you know, exercising. It's the same way with these forests that are overchoked. So that's what we call ecological restoration approach, to try to restore natural conditions first by removing the excess trees and then by safely reintroducing more natural fire.
So you bring the loggers in to remove the trees, or how does that happen?
That's the hope. And one of the things that's, I think, particularly innovative about 4FRY is that we're trying to look at these trees not as a liability, which they are, as they are out on the landscape right now, but as an asset that can help pay for the restoration of wildlife habitat, watersheds, and natural conditions across the land. So the hope is that we'll be able to remove those trees and then get forest industry, wood industry, to help pay for the cost of the trees.
So that's where everybody sees, all industry, forest management, forest service, that's where they see it's a win-win-win-win for everybody.
That's our hope.
And how far along are we on this, Mary?
Right now we have what we call a request for proposals, an RFP out for a contract that would be 300,000 acres of thinning, which is the biggest the Forest Service has ever put out there. We don't know the results yet, and we won't for a little bit. But
Create jobs, right?
It would definitely create jobs locally. That's a really positive thing. This is very much a win-win situation. By doing that, we include the whole breadth of the stakeholders for part of
Everybody's involved. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll take hopefully some questions from the audience. Don't be afraid to step up to the mic there. Here.
This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create and manage a high-quality website or blog. With Squarespace, you can create a website that's uniquely you, write a blog you've been thinking about, display photos from Flickr, or connect website visitors to your pages on Facebook or Twitter. Choose from hundreds of design templates to get started, plus mobile apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android to update your site on the go. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, you say it easily and with style with Squarespace. Here's a special Sci-Fi offer. Go to squarespace.com, sign up for a free account, then use the offer code ScienceFriday9 for 10% off for 6 months if you decide to purchase. That's squarespace.com, offer code ScienceFriday9. If you're a Sci-Fi listener who uses Squarespace, please let us know. Post a link on our Facebook wall at facebook.com/sci-fry. Thank you, Squarespace, for your support of Science Friday.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. We're talking this hour about wildfires, coming to you from Flagstaff, Arizona, with my guests Wally Covington, Mary Latta, Paul Sommerfeld. We were talking about the 4FRY program, and there are some critics of it, especially, I'll just name one, whom we talked to, the Sierra Club, does not condone logging on public lands, and told us, how do we know the Forest Service will do what the stakeholders ask for? Who's going to monitor this to make sure that things get done?
We would call it thinning, not logging. Logging has a lot of bad connotations these days for some reasons that are good. The stakeholders right now have a subgroup, the Science and Monitoring Committee, that is putting together an adaptive management plan for us. Mm-hmm. What they've done in the past, we have other documents they put together that we use to help structure how we write it, so the public has lots and lots of opportunities to comment on what we're doing and let us know what they're happy with and what they aren't. And the Sierra Club is part of the stakeholder group that is shows up regularly and has lots of input to what we do.
Oh, okay. Let's go to the audience here. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I would like to know why we don't give out camping permits or fire permits until too late into the year. A lot of these fires that have been devastating have been caused by campfires that have gotten out of control. And it seems like we wait until July, when it's very dry, to put out no more campfires. And I'd like to see it happen in February. Thank you.
No one has volunteered to answer that question.
No, I realize Mary? I'm Forest Service and people are looking at me, but I'm not involved in that part of it. I know it's partly politics and largely safety. It's a win. Well, it's not always a win-win. If you're the Forest Supervisor making that decision, you're going to make somebody mad no matter what you are doing, and I think that's a difficult decision to make.
Paul, you're not afraid of making people mad, so what do you think?
No, I guess I'm not. That's a very good question, and there is some, and I think this year we saw some changes as a result of what has occurred in the past. The decision to restrict activities in the forest or to get to the point of closure of a forest is not done alone by the Forest Service, at least in our area. We've been able to engage with a number of stakeholders, whether it's the city, the county, the state, and the Grand Canyon, the Park Service, and then the Forest Service as well, both the Kaibab and the Coconino, to try and make sure that the restrictions that are put in place are done simultaneously so we don't have some areas that are closed and some areas that are open where, by and large, the public can't tell which side of a fence is federal land, which side of a fence is non-federal land. So there's weekly calls that go on that have gone on for the last several years during that time of the year, looking at trends, where we are with conditions, resource availability to suppress fires that do occur, and then decisions are made. And looking back, some decisions probably have been made too late. I mean, that's the risk you run in this kind of business. But I think that on the other side of that, where decisions have been made proactively, we have seen it. Great impact in terms of the kinds of fires that we have and the number.
So. All right. Let's go to this side of the auditorium. Yes.
Hi. I'm a Northern Arizona native, and I've seen the forest change in my lifetime, and I've heard my dad and my grandpa talk about it. And my father was a hotshot, which is a wildland firefighter, and they'd send them out to clear the forest to do some mechanical and brush burning. And but then they'd send it back in to plant three trees for every tree they cut down. And I was wondering if the Four-Fry program put back some local control so you didn't have to worry about this national regulation that when you cut down a tree in the national forest, you got to plant another one.
I'm not aware of any law that says you have to plant one. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is there's a number of techniques. One is called evidence-based, where particularly in the areas where we're trying to restore grasslands and savanna, we're looking at where we see big stumps or we see stump holes and we know there were trees. And if it's an area that's encroached, we will leave, I'm not sure if it's 1-to-1 or 2-to-1, so that we can try and restore that historic structure. But we're not planting anything.
Okay. Thank you.
One question for you, Mary, while I have you there. How often, ideally, do forests need to burn? And Wally, you can jump in and talk about that. Is there an ideal number? Or?
Well, it varies with climate. And while you finish this thought, I can tell you what we're looking at right now. Based on talking to Paul and others, what we're writing in is a maintenance interval. And the intent of that is how long can a forest that starts out in a really good condition go and not start seeing really bad effects from fire when it does burn? And a top number on that would be roughly 20. We would like to see in our Four-Fry area a fire return interval of about 10 years. Historically around here, we're looking at 2 to 21, depending on exactly where you're at and the cycle of weather.
Wally?
Yeah. Mary, you nailed it.
Thank God.
You talked about the fires in the canopy and burning very hot. What does a really hot-burning fire do to the to the ecosystem surrounding it.
Yeah, so, you know, when we talk about fire-adapted forest, there are several kinds of fire-adapted forest. One is, we're all familiar, I think, from the fires of 1988 up in Yellowstone. The lodgepole pine forest has experienced and co-evolved with crown fire. So they have adaptations that allow them to respond, serotonous cones and others that we've talked about in the past, mm-hmm. That allow them to thrive under crown fire conditions. The frequent fire forest, which ponderosa pine and longleaf pine in the southeast are kind of the characteristic forest of that type, have evolved under surface fires. And the surface fires sustain these forests. Many of the plants and animals besides the dominant trees require surface fires to thrive. So in trying to do ecological restoration, what we try to do is to get as close to a self-regulating ecosystem as we can get. In this case, it would be with a fairly frequent fire regime. Going in the opposite direction, though, is that these fires produce a lot of smoke, and the smoke is a health hazard. Mm-hmm. So that's where we look at what is the maximum interval, which we think might be around 20 years, where you could still sustain the basic functions of the ecosystem and yet manage the smoke from them. Mm-hmm.
Let's go, yes, here, and then I'll go there. Yes, yes, sir.
Good morning. I'm a resident of Flagstaff, and I've got a third of an acre here in town. And when I'm sitting on my porch looking at the beautiful trees on my property, I got two questions. One is, how many trees were on my property, say, 300 years ago before Europeans got here? And two, what's the maximum number of trees I should have on my property for safety?
Well, let me answer that, if
go
I
ahead,
could.
Bob.
And the first, in response to the first question, that would the number of trees that existed on the property 300 years ago was, in most cases, probably in all likelihood, much less than what's there now. In terms of your second question of how many should you have, that's totally dependent upon the site and your property. The best answer for that is given in the field, standing with you on your property. And so I would encourage you, you can call us or visit with me after this, and we will come and look at your property with you and talk about those questions.
There you go. Thanks.
So one additional point. When you look at, we've got studies throughout Western North America in the ponderosa pine type, and generally speaking, the densities before fire exclusion were somewhere between 50 and 40 or so trees per acre. Current densities are somewhere between 400 and several thousand trees per acre. So when Paul says you've likely got more trees than were natural, than is the natural carrying capacity, you got typically a whole lot more trees than can be sustained on the site.
Yeah. We have a tweet here from Dodge who writes, why do we not get forest fires in the Northeast like you guys are getting? Are our dry summers simply not dry enough?
Well, I will say that the Northeast does have fire. Some of the most devastating fires we've had in this country have been in the New Jersey Pine Barrens. New York, Long Island had a major fire about 15 years ago. So they do occur, but the reason they don't occur as often is the type of vegetation and the weather patterns. Much more humid, and you don't have the fuel buildup that we have in the West because material in the East typically decomposes fairly rapidly. It does not do that here.
It's a little dry here.
And it's drier.
It's drier. I want to ask you, don't be afraid to step up into the audience here and ask a question. Let me go to a question I've been wanting to ask for. Is it possible, Wally, after a big fire, that a stream or a river system, I mean, I know that you have the soil is going to be affected. It could be totally changed in what happens with the water in that forest area?
Yeah, we see this time and again. The Schultz fire that you referred to here in Flagstaff is a classic example. That's a fire that burned last year, about 15,000 acres, as you said. And what happens under these severe, unnatural crown fires is you burn up and kill the vegetation, the roots die, there's nothing to hold the soil or to prevent flooding from occurring. So what happens with crown fire is there's my old hydrologist at Yale used to call it the one-two punch. And the one punch is you kill a lot of the trees and animals on an area. The two punch is the soils start marching inexorably toward the sea. And as without cover, then the impact of the rain as the root systems decay over years, not just immediately after the fire, but over years, that soil starts moving downslope. And if you happen to have a human community below that, it's devastating. That's what we have going on right now in Flagstaff area.
Wow. Let's go to this lady here.
Okay, yes. Thank you. And hello and welcome, Ira, to Flagstaff.
Thank you.
This is for Wally or Mary. My question is, what effect, if any, does the bark beetle devastation contribute to these colossal fires?
Well, I could just say to date that this is Wally. So, obviously not Mary. To date, we have had some substantial bark beetle outbreaks, but that's likely the large landscape-scale bark beetle outbreaks in ponderosa pine is likely 5 years down the road, maybe 10 years down the road. The first thing that happens with an overabundance of trees in this type is you get that shift from surface to crown fire and then larger and larger crown fires. As time marches on and the trees get weaker and weaker due to intense competition, then they're more subjected to bark beetles. So it would be our anticipation that within the next 10 years, we'll see larger and larger bark beetle outbreaks. Now, if you think the Walla fire was bad with live trees on the site, just wait till you see something like that burn with dead trees on the site. We've seen that, and it's a much more devastating fire. It makes firefighting, the kind of stuff that Paul does, much, much more difficult. So it's likely to occur in the next 10 years or so. But one of the things about four-fry is that ecological restoration treatments solve a whole host of problems for wildlife habitat degradation, watershed degradation, reduction of threats from insects and disease, and also crown fire. Mary, did you have just anything else?
No, you're saying most of it, but yes. I'd want to add, for those people who aren't aware, most of you would be, I know we have a lot of forestry students here, but the bark beetle has absolutely devastated parts of the Central Rockies up in southern Wyoming and northern Colorado, the Black Hills, where you literally have tens of thousands of acres of dead trees. They get the red needles on them. When the needles die at that point, they're particularly flammable. Then the needles fall off, and you just got the big dead down trunks, and once those start to fall, the resistance to control is huge. Mm. Putting out those big trees is really hard. You can't get in there. You can't just walk through them. That's Paul's job then.
Let me remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from NPR. Ellie, get one question here from the audience. Yes.
I was wondering, how long does it take for a fire to destroy one tree?
A few seconds.
That's a good question.
Yeah, it is a good question because there's the initial killing of the tree that can occur when the needles are browned up, when they're killed. But over longer periods of time, the fire at the base of the tree can smolder and kill a tree over a period of 10 or 12 years. So that is a very good question. Most people, if they see green in the canopy after the fire has passed through, say, hey, everything's copacetic. You come back in 4 years' time, and there are a bunch of dead trees on the site very often.
That's a good question.
Very good question.
Do you have one for us also? Quickly.
How many animals get killed by the wildfire?
Another good question.
I think that's a little hard to answer. Not as many as you would think. When we say wildfire, I think we're all making the assumption that it's the bad fire versus the good fire. Even fires like the Wallow Fire and the Schultz Fire, there's parts of the areas that burned that it was ecologically a really good thing. In the fires that are of a historic nature, the low fires that aren't really dangerous and are good for the landscape, not many, probably very, very few.
One last question for you. It's like the question about, if you had all the money in the world and you wanted to study forests and fires, what do you need to know now? What would you like to know about the ecosystem or how they burn or whatever that you don't know that you'd like to study? Wally, you got to go, Mary? Paul? Is there a question that needs
to be asked? Yeah, so if we had all the money in the world, what we would do is probably landscape scale experiments. Back 30 or 40 years ago when I started out in this, I thought a really big experiment was 2 acres. But the kind of that was when we had small fires. Under current conditions, we can't just take results from a few acres and extrapolate that to the scale we need to operate now, which is hundreds of thousands of acres. So what I would do is start doing adaptive management experiments where we use the best available science, the strongest evidence, to design ways to try to restore these forests. And then I would actually pay for monitoring and evaluation to find out whether or not that's working.
That's always a good thing to find out. Thank you. We've run out of time for the segment. I want to thank you all for joining us. Wally Covington is Regents Professor of Forest Ecology, Executive Director of the Ecological Restoration Institute at Northern Arizona University. Mary Lotta is a fire ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service in Flagstaff, and Paul Sommerfeld is the Wildlife Fire Management Officer for the City of Flagstaff. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
And it's a pleasure meeting some of you. I've spoken over the phone for many years, and we get to actually see you in the flesh. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the Flagstaff Festival of Science. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. We are here this week to help kick off the Flagstaff Festival of Science. What makes Flagstaff's festival so special? I wager our next guests are going to tell us about that. John Grunsfeld is a physicist and former astronaut. He's also the deputy director of the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, and he's the keynote speaker for the Flagstaff Festival of Science. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Brian Bates is a professor of environmental studies at Coconino Community College in Flagstaff, Arizona. He's also on the board of directors for the Flagstaff Festival of Science. Thanks for being with us here today.
Thank you, Ira.
I know you're going to be giving the keynote speech tonight, John. Are you going to give us any hints of what you might be talking about, or want to keep it under wraps? We'll let you have to come to the festival to hear what he's going to talk about today. But tell us, you've been on the shuttle. You've flown the space shuttle 5 times, right, if I count it, and a lot of repair missions to the Hubble?
That's right. I've been incredibly fortunate that I've been able to fly into space 5 times. For me, it was a lifelong ambition. I had a close friend who I understand is a friend of yours, Jeff Hoffman, who's at MIT. We were both at MIT at the time when he was selected as an astronaut. I thought, well, if he can do it, you know. But it really actually is a trend that I think is very important, which is moving away from sending, you know, the test pilots up, who serve a very important function, to sending scientists and engineers and people who do scientific research into space.
Mm-hmm. You said, I'm going to quote you, you said, in space, you get in touch with your quantum self. I was a human cosmic ray detector. Whoa, what does that mean?
Well, I was on my 3rd mission on Spaceship Discovery. It was a mission to the Hubble Space Telescope, so we were relatively high altitude, about 600 kilometers above the Earth, 350 miles. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and we sleep with eye shades and earplugs in, and so our eyes were really dark adapted. If you were out here in Flagstaff with dark adapted eyes, you can see the beautiful skies at night, but this was inside the space shuttle, so no windows, eye shades on, and there was a light show going on. And being a physicist, I quickly realized that we must be flying through an area of the Earth's magnetic field where cosmic rays are kind of concentrated. It's called the South Atlantic Anomaly. And we were being bombarded by high-energy cosmic rays. These are atomic nuclei, atoms that have been stripped of all their electrons, traveling at virtually the speed of light. And I could see a sea of little white flashes representing all the protons that are zipping around, mostly from the sun, and occasionally a brighter flash that would be a carbon or an oxygen, traveling at virtually the speed of light. And our eyes are sensitive to that. We spend, you know, enormous sums of money to build specialized cosmic ray detectors. There's one on the International Space Station right now called the Antimatter Magnetic Spectrometer. But our human bodies are detectors themselves. It was fascinating.
You've got to be able to count pretty fast, though.
Oh, yeah.
A little faster than it's possible. Brian Bates, I don't want to give away the ending of your talk about Mayan civilization, but does the world end next year in 2012?
Oh, absolutely, Myra. Haven't you been reading the tabloids?
Why? Tell us about this conspiracy about the Mayans predicting the end of the world in 2012.
I don't think it's a conspiracy. I think it's a scientifically illiterate society that is believing a lot of junk.
Really?
Yeah. Fundamentally, the Mayans created an incredible mechanism by which to count. They're one of two early civilizations that created the concept of zero. And they also went on to build a vegesimal. How many of you could spell that? A vegesimal.
It's not something a chopper on you buy on TV or something.
No, no, okay, that's not. Okay. That's yeah. Science junk.
That's
So it's a base 20 counting system. Well, they used this base 20 counting system then and created a calendar that reflects astronomical patterns. Some of the things that Dr. Grunsfeld has seen out in outer space, but based upon Venus, based upon the movement of the sun from equinox, which, by the way, today is the equinox, and to the southern end and then back again. So actually it was their zenith passage. But based on all these patterns, then, they use their number system, they use their astronomy, they use their power of observation to build a system by which they could tell time. And that time never begins, it never ends. It is cycles of time. It is not the end of time.
Aha. Uh-huh. So that puts that to rest.
Let me share one thing real quickly. There's a stela, which is a limestone pillar that is hand-carved, and they would mark on these certain events and certain numbers. There's one in Macanach in Cuba, which I think is in Guatemala. It goes to an octillion years, 41 octillion years.
And why would they be so interested in the future like that?
They were transcending the Big Bang.
Yeah.
I really don't know. I hate to admit it, but I don't know. How do you even conceive of a number that size? And yet it's there.
And they could count that high. Now, how long would it take you to get? You couldn't even count that.
I wouldn't have to talk to a physicist to answer that one.
Yeah, does this fascinate you, John?
Actually, it does. And when I was an undergraduate, I was fascinated by the field of archaeoastronomy, studying what ancient people knew about astronomy. And it's in part because I believe that as long as humans have had consciousness, and I know last week you were talking about an early humanoid,
right?
Did those humanoids look up at the sky and wonder, you know, what's the extent of the universe? Did it begin? Does it end? And the things they observed were very important to them for the counting of time, for crop timing. Astronomy is, you know, one of the most ancient types of thought, and we're still on that pursuit. We're still asking those fundamental questions about where did we come from? Where are we going? How did we get here?
Well, let me ask our audience. If you have a question you'd like to ask, don't forget the microphones are here. Please step up to them. Time is a fascinating thing in all cultures, is it not?
Absolutely.
I mean, would you say that most of these things we find that are left over are some way connected to time or keeping track of time or direction or destiny or something like that?
What I can share with you, Ira, is that every culture that has seriously been looked at by archaeologists, folks that have a background in archaeoastronomy are now what is called cultural astronomy. In every culture that we've looked, we have found evidence that humans have been watching the movement of the skies since the beginnings of civilization. One of the things that I think is very fascinating, and this comes from Dr. Tony Avini at Colgate University, is that Alexander the Great was going to attack Egypt. However, his astronomers came to him and said, hey, wait a minute, Mars is in the wrong place. You can't attack now. And based upon their observation of the movement of the planets and based upon their interpretation of that information, Alexander the Great decided not to attack Egypt, but instead went to India.
He took advice from his astronomers.
He took advice from the scientists.
From his astronomers. We don't hear a lot of that these days either.
No, unfortunately we don't. which I think is a great topic for a future radio show.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about it when we can. Let's talk about archaeoastronomy a bit. Different cultures basically put things, we see these petroglyphs and things, and mm-hmm. what were the purposes of these things up there?
I think that there is a wonderful role for science in the development of civilizations. And part of that is, how do I begin to know when I should plant my beans, my squash, my corn, such that it will bear fruit before the first frost of the year? So part of this is a transition from hunter-gatherer societies to agricultural societies. Now, keep in mind, this is going on over 10,000 years. This isn't right. something that you wake up on one day and you start doing the next. No, it's a long-term process. So I think that there's a real survival process that's involved. When do I anticipate rain? When do I anticipate changes in the seasonal weather patterns? But beyond that, it's also about, when do I anticipate that the sun will stand still, and what can I do in order to tell what I perceive as the gods to bring the sun back? What do I do in order to celebrate the length of days and how it changes? For example, the Hopi are now beginning, as of today, they begin the Mamzara ceremony, which is actually a woman's ceremony. But if you go to the textbooks, if you go to the library, you will never find it there, because all the ethnographers were males. And how many women are going to tell males from Chicago, how many Hopi women will tell males from Chicago about their rites of puberty rights and their transitions from girlhood into womanhood? And yet that's what the Hopis are celebrating during this next week.
Very interesting. Let's go to the audience for a question. You were first. Go ahead.
Hi. My friend just went to CERN and took a tour yesterday, and he knew I was coming here, so he asked me to ask you a question. But I think it's better directed at John, given what you said about your third space trip. Firstly, given the evidence that came out yesterday that seems to say there's something that does travel faster than the speed of light, what is your opinion of perhaps Einstein's theory? How has that shifted? But my friend asked me to say what... What should he have asked on the tour at CERN that he didn't ask?
John, you want to comment on that? That first bit of data that's in?
Well, anytime there's something that radically challenges a theory that has been supported for many years by many different types of evidence, you have to be a little bit skeptical. I think, the more remarkable thing is that we have tested Einstein's theory of gravity over scales from, the very small, the micro, and in environments, tiny little experiments with tiny little masses, to the whole scale of the universe. And we see things that are unusual. And, when you look at our understanding of the universe in general, either from particle experiments smashing atoms together to replicate the conditions of the Big Bang, or look at the expansion of the universe, we get very satisfied that we're understanding everything. But lest we get too comfortable, let me point out that just in the last 10 or so years, when we've added up all of our understanding, we still have dark energy, dark matter, details of gravity that we don't understand. And it turns out when you add all that up, in a pie chart or something like that, it adds up to about 96% of everything in the universe. So we still really only understand a very little bit, so I'm sure there's lots of surprises out there. And that's what I always ask when I go to new facilities that are ramping up in energy and intensity, like the large collider at CERN is, what do you think will be the next great discovery?
That's interesting. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Or as Carl Sagan used to say, great claims require great amounts of evidence. And this being the first, a little bit of evidence, a lot of people have to replicate this to see if there's something wrong with the experiment, or was Einstein wrong? Yes, and then we'll go over here.
Do you believe on life on other planets?
These simple questions today are getting harder. The hardest answers,
yep.
Aren't they?
But these are questions that are coming from emerging scientists, and I love to have kids in the audience because they always ask the questions that we really need to begin to look at.
Yeah.
Okay. So
that's
first,
what I'm going to let John answer.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great question that overlaps both of our disciplines.
Absolutely.
Up here, because people have always wondered about that, and they've drawn petroglyphs about it, and or at least we think so, and talked about it. And it's a very personal question. Again, it's a scientific question. Has anybody ever landed in a large spaceship in a populated area, walked out, other than in the movies, and said, I'm from some distant star system, and no, they haven't. And so we have to, you know, kind of use our own imagination. If you look at our universe of 20 years ago or so, we knew about 9 planets in the whole universe. That's it. And then, of course, we demoted Pluto, so we're down to 8.
No, but, we haven't.
But just in the last, well, it's a dwarf planet, but just in the last, according to some, not here in Flagstaff.
In Flagstaff, it's a real planet.
And it has lots of moons. Hubble Space Telescope has been observing Pluto, and we keep finding moons of Pluto. But we now know about over 600 planets. The Kepler experiment has another 1,200 candidates. So it looks like planets are everywhere. We think that Earth-like planets are probably very common, Earth-sized planets anyway. And what we don't know is there another place like Earth? But the odds are so monumental. We have 200 billion stars in our own galaxy. There's about 200 billion galaxies in the universe. So the odds are that there's lots of Earths out there in habitable zones with liquid water and continents and volcanism. And so still the question is there is, are we alone in the universe? And I'll talk a little bit about that tonight. But let me just ask the audience, live audience here in Flagstaff, how many people think that there must be other life out there?
Wow.
So it's at least more than half of the audience.
Oh, at least more than half of the audience. Yeah. Did you want to sum up, Ryan?
Very quickly, I was teaching chemistry at Coconino Community College this morning, and we're going through the periodic table, which, of course, is the repeating patterns of the elements. If we go from the assumption, and, of course, CERN now is challenging our assumptions, which is what science is all about, if we look at the nature of matter, if that's consistent throughout the universe, then what would prevent those molecules from a forming into other living creatures? They may not be in our structure. They may not have the life history that we've had on this planet. Maybe they have something very different. But it's beyond my comprehension to have such an incredible universe and only have one planet that has life on it.
So let me add one last thing, which is the young lady actually wants to know the answer to that question, presumably. How will we answer it, other than somebody coming and visiting us, which is relatively unlikely? And the answer is astronomy. We're actually on the verge of being able to characterize a planet around a nearby star such that we could detect life. And the next step is going to be with the James Webb Space Telescope. It will be able to observe the atmospheres of planets around nearby stars. This is launching in 2018, and determine whether there's liquid oceans and ozone in the atmosphere, which is a sign of oxygen, CO2, methane, an organic molecule. So we'll be able to characterize it. Probably not enough to tell if anybody's at home. But I think the next generation of telescope beyond James Webb Space Telescope would have the capability to actually see if anybody's home.
If we fund them.
If we fund them.
Yeah. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for taking the time to be with us. John Grunsfeld is a physicist, a former astronaut. He is also deputy director of the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, where they look at all those Hubble pictures. And he's the keynote speaker for the Flagstaff Festival of Science, which is beginning this weekend. Brian Bates is a professor of environmental studies at Coconino Community College in Flagstaff. Thank you both for taking the time to be with us today.